Welcome to Creature Culture, a podcast about the monsters, spooks, and nasty guys that inhabit your favorite fantasy settings. We're your hosts. Hi, I'm Colin, and I was turned into an ash tree for slighting Hera.
Hi, I'm Noel, and I'm only grassy after I've had beans.
And today we're talking about a race that we hope really grows on you,
Dryads.
But I guess no news and updates. Nothing has really happened.
Yeah. There's no new year, nothing spectacular.
January happened.
It was a thing. It happened and then it's gone.
Oh, I guess this is a news worth mentioning. Yeah. So if anyone would like to meet me in person and yell at me about fantasy races, I will be at the Mid-Atlantic Gaming Festival. Towards the end of February, like the 18th or the 20th or something.
Oh, that's pretty cool.
Yeah, I'll be there. You can come say hi. I'll, tweet at me so we can find each other. I don't know if any of your listeners are really on the East Coast, but if you are, and you want to go to MAGFest, I'll be there. You can try some meat I made.
Yeah, give them my regards.
Yeah.
On the subject of February, remember, folks, this is a leap year, so you'll be getting one extra day in this month.
You will not be getting one extra podcast, though.
No, you will not. Sorry. We're devoted, but,
I guess by the time the next podcast comes out, it'll be past Valentine's Day, if that's your thing.
Yeah, it will.
Yeah.
Well, happy Valentine's Day, I guess.
Yeah. I hope you have plans to do something fun alone or with other people or, whatever. Yeah.
Remember, it's important to enjoy yourself even if you don't have someone to do Valentine's Day with.
Don't try and go out and dinner that night. It'll be atrocious.
Yeah, just not worth it.
Yeah, lines out the door.
Ugh, just no, never.
It's like trying to get brunch on Mother's Day. Don't even bother.
No, any kind of meal on Mother's Day is just awful. It doesn't work, period.
Don't eat on Mother's Day.
You could make food and you'd have people coming to your door. Hey, you got spots open?
Yeah. You got a two-top. Here's my mom. We digress. We digress. Well, I mean, technically you would use grass to dye other things.
Granted.
That's,
I mean, if you fed it, or if you watered it with only dyed water, you could probably dye grass.
You know, we've never really gotten to textile materials
we
in
haven't.
The show before. That's
We
okay.
really haven't.
Yeah.
That's something that you can bring up.
Something for another time. we've been clamoring for 10 episodes now, or not 9 episodes. This is the 10th episode.
Right.
We've been clamoring for several episodes asking for you guys to ask questions, and you guys did!
Yes!
Yeah, so let's answer some questions.
Let's do that.
Yeah. First up, Renart?
We have one from Renart asking, how would gnolls adapt to living in a swampy environment?
Yes, and specifically if it would be, since it's so different from the typical way that we're kind of introduced to them in like a more arid or...
Usually a savanna-like or plains or sometimes forest or mountain, never in swamps.
Yeah, it's very wet and, sometimes animals don't like wet stuff.
Generally, yeah, it's harder for things to live in consistently swampy areas. It promotes sickness, illness, infection, that sort of thing.
Yeah, I don't think it would cause any problems for gnolls whatsoever, though.
No, it wouldn't. It would not at all.
Yeah.
In fact, it might actually be to their advantage.
Yeah.
Because, granted, they are usually, as was mentioned before, endurance hunters, which means they pursue things until they get tired, and then they kill them. Well, eat them, then kill them. But, in a swampy environment, they could easily adapt towards, ambush hunting.
Yeah.
Towards traps and sneaking and that sort of thing.
Yeah, and definitely if they're in more of a, kind of a peat bog environment, or if it's kind of like an estuary environment where there is solid land combined with marsh and swamp like environments, definitely you'll have animals there and creatures that really only can handle the land, and they can still, in addition to being able to use more ambush hunter like stuff, they can still use the endurance hunter kind of attack style to basically corral them into places where, all right, well, now this deer that doesn't really know how to swim is stuck on the end of a peninsula in the middle of a swamp, and they've got nowhere to go, and it just makes it a little bit easier for them.
Just a little bit. One also has to consider that if it wasn't, a full aqua swamp, if it were just swampy land, they would still be all right.
Yeah.
Because generally, gnolls tend to be depicted with larger paws, larger foot paws, which would allow them a little better of an ability to walk on squishier land.
Yes.
Because it distributes themselves more evenly, rather like how something walks on snow.
Yeah.
Now, if it was a more aquatic area, it would be interesting to see them adjusting to that. Because gnolls are known to be to enjoy swimming. It's mentioned in a few sources that they love water.
Yeah.
Imagine them acting almost like a crocodile.
Yeah.
Wouldn't that be neat?
I now I'm just imagining like a gnoll like rolling around on top of its dead food to kill it.
I mean, honestly.
Well, they do that normally anyways. I remember when we first got this question and we were kind of like, I don't know, running it back and forth just for basic ideas. The thing that immediately came to my mind is Portuguese and Spanish water dogs.
Right.
And water dogs in general. Where I know we've established more of like a hyena thing for gnolls. But I feel like the kind of look of a water dog where the reason they're successful at being kind of marine hunters going between, you know, land and lakes and rivers and that kind of stuff is that their hair naturally curls and dreads itself so that it's, you know, it doesn't get matted or they don't get infections or that kind of thing, or right. It doesn't, you know, just kind of get dirty all the time.
Right.
And I feel like that's kind of a cool look you could give to a swamp living gnoll tribe where they have, you know, they don't look, you know, wet and muddy all the time. They have this kind of curled, dreaded fur that just kind of naturally is water resistant.
Or if not naturally, they could apply fat and lard.
Yeah.
And that would be perfect because it would apply the traditional gnoll scent. It would just be something that's actually very appropriate, using every last bit.
Yeah. One of the most interesting things I think this brings to gnolls is I feel like it gives them an opportunity where they actually do have to kind of approach the kind of material practices that we originally said they would have no need for.
Right.
Because if they're in this environment, you know, something getting waterlogged and infected really doesn't matter to them because they have literally a stomach that can digest almost anything. They're mm-hmm. not going to get diseased from anything.
Right.
But the fact that everything is waterlogged all the time means that if they don't do something to protect their foods and their craft goods, they will deteriorate very fast and simply fall apart and no longer be usable.
Right. Which is something they want to avoid.
Yeah. So even if you don't... I still don't think that gnolls in a swamp environment would be building, you know, structures or cities or anything.
Certainly not.
But definitely, I think that we could see stuff like, you know, them making containers and burying food in the swamp and
right.
in places that they would remember to go back and get it. Because, you know, otherwise, if it gets left out to where water can get to it, even if it gets infected, they aren't going to care about that, but it's going to just deteriorate. Whereas if they bury it, well, the water's not going to get to it. It also means they can have things like gnoll kimchi or
right.
Gnoll wine or something.
Alternative solution, imagine them hanging it off trees.
That too.
Or putting it in containers up in trees. Or, thought, making small rafts that float on top of the water and just keeping their stuff there in one communal raft.
Yeah. I feel like that's also another good thing because... But does present, you know, if they're just hanging it from a tree or they have it on a raft, it's very easy for other things to steal. But at that point, they're probably using it as bait as much as storage.
Exactly. Because, sure, you'll lose maybe a bite or two out of whatever it is they get, but you'll catch the thing eating it. And that's net gain.
Yeah. Because that thing is old, and this new thing is fresh.
Right. And if you let it hang out, they'll both be old. And that's great.
Listener Blackheart asked, what if a gnoll ate God? Well, I don't think he wouldn't be hungry anymore.
Granted.
Yeah.
And I mean, if you follow the biological 10% rule, where you get 10% of the energy of whatever you eat, 10% of infinity is still infinity.
Yeah. Here's the thing that I would be concerned about. Do gnolls have such efficient digestive systems that whatever made a god's energy special would just get broken down into baser parts?
Ooh, fair. That's a thought.
Yeah.
Ooh, that would suck.
Yeah.
Oh, boy. Literally anything else could eat a god and be totally okay and gain all their power, but the yeah. gnolls would be like, damn it, I'm hungry.
I think that'd be the like, kind of, like, obviously, a gnoll that can kill a god to eat it, it's probably pretty powerful already.
Granted, that's Hinogu level at least.
And I feel like it just kind of like it would be like a nice little bit of irony that out of anything, a gnoll eats a god and it's just like eating anything else for them.
That would be horrible.
Yeah.
Oh god, I'm actually a little angry, but it's true.
I think out of anything, gnolls could definitely eat God. Like,
oh, definitely.
Like, you have, especially in, like, Judeo-Christian, like, influence stuff, you have the idea that, oh, to look upon or hear God will, like, you know, your eyes will burst open and your ears will cause your brain to sizzle and whatever.
Of course, yeah.
Similarly, I feel like in the same kind of context, if a human ate God meat, that they would just burn up as their own caloric... breakdown of the God food.
It would just be so heavy and so rich in energy. Even 10% of that's going to kill them.
Yeah, their stomach would literally light on fire and just blow them up from the inside out.
Terrifying.
But a gnoll could handle it.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
No question. Next, and finally, we have a question from Wayward Kobold. What's the difference between a dryad and a nymph? Leading us into our main topic.
Yes. We will definitely cover this a lot more in just a second, but essentially, a dryad is a variety of nymph.
Right.
Nymphs are a class of spirit or supernatural entity or something from Greek folklore, that basically it's a low-level deity figure that's tied to a specific place. So most commonly that's, a nymph is tied to a river or a fountain or a spring. But if you have a dryad that is tied to a tree that is specifically, if you have a nymph that is tied to a tree, that is referred to as a dryad.
Right. And more specifically, a nymph that is part of the tree is a hamadryad.
Yeah.
Which is pretty cool little piece of trivia.
Yeah. And going to the important bit of clarification, the episode is titled Dryads.
Right.
But we will be talking about dryads, ints, mandragoras, aurons, and any general different kind of plant person.
It's true. Dryads were the seed of this, but it's growing out into something else.
Yeah.
It's just stemming out. And...
yeah. Kind of branching out.
Yep. Yeah.
If you don't like that we're covering, we're kind of grouping together so many different things under a single banner, turn this podcast off, go leaf about for a bit, and come back for the next one.
Okay. No more. I wanted to nip it in the bud, but I couldn't.
Man, just, we'll probably prune this part out in editing.
Uh-huh, yeah.
All right, so let's start things off with dryads.
What are dryads?
That's kind of really up in the air. Like, classically, they're hot teenage girls.
Basically, yes.
Yeah, I mean, from the pervy, voyeuristic Renaissance paintings that made them so popular.
Yep.
They're sexy young girls.
Yes,
they were. Who hang out near trees.
Yes. And that's it. That's basically it.
Yeah, but, I mean, as far as actual source material, they don't really... they're often called beautiful and young, but you never really get any kind of descriptor of what they look like.
Right. It's generally left open to the person who's reading or looking.
Yeah.
It's part of the mystique of it, I suppose.
Yeah.
They're beautiful, but your version of beautiful is different from someone else's. Yeah. That sort of thing going on.
And definitely in kind of contemporary sources, it'll range anything from a tree with a face on it, to a kind of ghostly entity around a tree, to a naked woman covered in bark.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's an uncommon one, but kind of like it, actually.
Yeah.
It's a little more interesting than, normal human person who hangs around the tree, which is the most common depiction.
Yes. Definitely, there's a lot of erotic fantasy art that revolve around tree fuckers.
The absolute truth.
Yeah.
Total saps, a lot of them.
But yeah, dryads.
Dryads.
Dryads are tree nymphs. Dryad is the Greek name for them. The Roman term is absolutely impronounceable for me, and I took Latin for 4 years.
I'm looking at the spelling, and it's ridiculous.
Let me try and pronounce this real quick.
Give it a triad.
Yeah. Quirquetulani. Yes.
Okay. Don't try it.
Yeah.
Hurts.
Yeah. Basically, Definitely as far as Roman myth, drawing a lot from Greek myth, as far as folklore stuff.
Yeah.
Holcloth, the Roman concept of nymphs is the Greek concept of nymphs.
Right. It's one of the things they just lifted and were like, we like this. Yeah. We're taking it.
If there is any actual difference, it's that in Greek myth, dryads and nymphs in general are much more of a nature spirit.
Right.
They're an actual figure. You know, you would make sure that your if you had a spring near your farm, you would make sure that the nymph is happy, that kind of thing.
Yeah, of course.
Whereas as you kind of cycle towards Roman mythology, where you start to go more from folklore to myth, from storytelling to poetry, nymphs become that thing that you have around so that Zeus or Jove has a young lady to be lusting after, or that kind of thing.
Right. Which is kind of important when you're talking about Zeus or Jove.
Yeah. But definitely, especially in, you know, stuff like the works of Ovid, it can get pretty misogynistic.
As things tended to.
Yeah. It's basically like you'll have your big manly centaurs, and if they're there and they're at a party, well, you're going to have some nymphs that get, you know, assaulted.
Of course. What have you.
And definitely it doesn't help that that thing got picked up by Renaissance painting, where like nymphs were an excuse to paint, you know, sexy ladies all the time.
Which you don't need an excuse.
Yeah.
You just do it. Just don't be a dick about it.
Yeah. but yeah, nymphs, I guess dryads, you know, they're tree spirits.
Right.
Dryads are actually specifically nymphs that inhabit oak trees.
This is true.
Yeah, and any given, tree nymph will have a different name depending on what species of tree they live in.
For example, ash trees called melial.
Yeah.
I thought that was pretty cool. There's also, you know, cherry and apple woods and stuff like that.
Yeah.
Don't remember them, though.
Yeah. It kind of creates a cool thing where, you know, each little different tree has its little quirks to it.
Right.
Yeah.
And I like that. I like the idea of different dryads of different trees all looking similar, like, in their species of tree, but they're all looking different in between each other.
Yeah.
I like that a lot. It's something that you don't actually see.
Yeah, yeah. It's like when the Pokemon breeding redraws got really popular this past year.
Those were so good.
Yeah, just like, especially the ones where the differences are just subtle enough that you can tell, you know, which other Pokemon they're bringing into it, but they still all look a part of the same thing.
Yes, where it's not like you've got like 10 different, completely different Pokemon.
Yeah.
But they're supposedly from the same breed.
Yeah.
Now, it's interesting, and I like it, but I like better the ones where it's very much the same, with little tweaks.
Yeah. And definitely, you know, man, I've always really liked wood, and, you know, studying the different varieties of wood and...
Yep, that's wood.
Yeah. Identifying wood, if you will.
Yeah.
And just kind of the... Especially as someone who went through art school and had to take several, sculpture classes, like trying to figure out what wood would be best for a project from a material standpoint, but also from a symbolic standpoint.
Yeah.
Trees are cool.
that would be interesting, honestly.
Yeah. In addition to there being, you know, dryads who are natural, there's also a huge, huge number of stories where eventually someone's punishment is they get turned into a tree.
Right.
And are effectively a dryad.
Effectively. Although oftentimes without the mobility.
Yes. That's a thing that varies back and forth. I guess that's the big difference between dryads and hamadryads, is usually hamadryads are someone who has been turned into and stuck in a tree.
Gotcha.
Yeah. But you have all different kinds of stuff. Off the top of my head, there is one where you have the sun, being a male god, like to get around.
Of course.
And there was this one of his children, you know, his mother told him, hey, you know, your dad, the sun god. That's why he's not around, because he's the sun and he's a god. And so he spent all of his time bragging about that. And everyone was like, no, you're a liar. Your dad's probably some soldier that was here on duty, like that kind of stuff. And so he was like, no, like, that's the sun's my dad, and I'm proud of that. And so he eventually travels all the way to the palace of the sun to meet his father, to have his father acknowledge him, so he can prove that, yes, I am the son of the sun.
Right.
And,
I am son.
Yeah, and he goes there, and his dad's like, yeah, no, you're my son. Like, yeah, like, yeah, like, I wouldn't lie about that. Like, you're my son.
Yeah.
I'm sorry I haven't been there for you.
I've been the son.
Yeah. What can I do for you? Like, I want to make it up to you. I want to be there for you, son, because right. I'm the son.
Right.
And tragically, the kid's like, let me drive your chariot that pulls the sun.
Oh, no.
Because you have the sun god who's the sun, but he also has a chariot that's actually the sun that he
pulls. So it pulls the sun.
It's pulled by flaming horses or whatever. And he's like, slow your roll. You're not ready for that. Is there anything else? And he's like, listen, I'm your son. You've never been there for me. You're going to let me drive this chariot so everyone sees me driving it. And yeah. And he's like, okay, all right, you can do it. And I would imagine that driving a chariot with like four flaming horses that reflects the power of the sun is pretty difficult.
Right.
It turned out to be. He couldn't keep it on a slight track, so he kept weaving too close and too far away, causing different parts of the earth to either completely burn up or freeze over.
Right.
And so the other gods were like, hey, you've got a, what are you doing? And he's like, it's my son, don't worry about it. And like Zeus is like, if I don't do something about this right now, all of Greece is going to light on fire. And he's like, no, just, it's going to be okay. And Zeus is like, no. So he threw a thunderbolt. And he killed the guy's son and blew up the chariot to save the world.
Basically. Well, yeah. But one good thing Zeus did.
Yeah. And he felt really bad about it, but he decreed, it's like, listen, this is a terrible idea. Everyone acknowledged this is a terrible idea. And you're allowed to grieve for a little bit, but like, really, this is a terrible idea. Well, this guy had seven sisters. I might be wrong on that number. It might be 12. He had a large number of sisters.
Yes.
They all went and they grieved and lamented. But then they took it a little too far and they started cursing the gods for killing their brother.
Of course.
So Hera turned them all into trees.
As she's wont to do.
Yes. So there's tons of different stories like that. Bacchus is from a tree story.
Right.
This is gonna get a little creepy.
It's Greek.
No, this is, especially the passage in Ovid is one of the creepiest things I have ever read. Like, this ranks up there with some of the worst erotic fan fiction I have ever seen.
Oh, dear.
Yes. You have this young girl.
Oh, here we go.
And she is in love with her father.
Of course.
She gets her father really, really drunk on a feast night.
Of course.
And has somehow gets something over on their maid. So the maid takes she helps her father back to his bedroom and leaves. And then puts on like a veil and gets her maid to bring her in and introduce her to her own father as her mother.
As one does.
Yeah. And the following passages as they make love is the creepiest thing I've ever read in as a part of any academic class. The father eventually sobers up after the deed is done, realizes what he has done, and pokes out his eyes with a torch and then jumps off a cliff.
That seems to be the thing for any kind of incest is taking out your eyes.
Yeah.
That's...
The girl is so, like, she's so heartbroken over it because her father, who she's in love with, has just committed suicide
So she's lost a father and a lover.
Yeah. Tries to commit suicide. Zeus comes down and is like, you're real fucked up.
Damn!
You've broken some natural laws.
From Zeus?
Yeah. Yeah!
Holy hell!
But Zeus is like, but you've got that unborn child there. Doesn't deserve all this. I'm gonna turn you into a tree. And so he turns it into a tree. And then he cuts open the tree and takes the baby out of the tree and then puts the baby in his thigh and carries the baby to term in his thigh and then births the child. And since, even though the child came from mortal stock, he was born from a god, technically. So he became a god. And that is how Dionysus, or Bacchus, was born.
Jesus.
Yeah.
I really wish I hadn't known that. I wish I could go back to not knowing that.
Yeah, the thigh thing is very strange. But that
no,
is...
I'm okay with that. That bit's the most normal of the story. Honestly. Ah.
Greece wild.
Greece wild.
Yeah. But yeah, in general, the whole spirit that occupies or guards a tree is pretty common around the world.
Right.
You have the Gilead Dhu, which is a Scottish tree spirit.
Right.
In kind of mirror to the Greek, you know, version of it, Gilead Dhus are male.
Yes.
They're generally very shy. And they generally either don't leave their tree or don't move very far from it.
Right.
And are kind of, I don't know, they often get used as that, you know, dark, mysterious, you know, lovely spirit that the lady falls in love with kind of thing. Who's right. A tree?
Whereas, ironically, the original was very short, kind of ugly.
Yeah.
As things go.
You have Kodama.
Yes.
Which are Japanese tree kami. Also, to varying degrees, are kind of similar to, I don't know, the more Chinese influence, where you might have a giant tree that is kind of like the agricultural spirit for your given community.
Yeah.
Go kind of halfway between that and general small spirits that live in trees.
Right. Like the cute little guys from Mononoke.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, like they're definitely Kodama, but same thing, is just the spirit of an old tree is also a Kodama.
Right. I think that's cool.
Yeah. Probably even, you know, the spirit of the forest in Princess Mononoke could probably, you know, interpreted as a Kodama.
Right, right. I imagine all the little ones are just the spirits of the individual trees, but then the entire forest together forms a whole nother spirit.
And those, the same kind of thing is kind of the inspiration for the Kokiri and Kurok in, and the, by extension, the Deku tree in Legend of Zelda.
Right? That makes sense.
Yeah.
I mean, the influence is pretty obvious there.
Yeah.
And I rather like it.
Definitely. It hits a little bit more home in Wind Waker, where they are actual tree people.
Right.
But, you know, Deku Scrubs and all that kind of stuff are still, like, that's all in a cool little similar realm.
Yeah. Where basically a lot of things are very similar in the different games.
Yeah.
I like that.
Definitely the Kokiri children are a little closer to, I don't know, classical concepts of elves. But they do,
by
sticking closer to what elves used to be versus what elves are now,
yes.
They bleed over into the idea of like dryads and tree spirits and that stuff too, which is really cool.
Rightly so. Let's see.
We have your personal favorite from this little research jaunt.
Yes.
How do you even say that?
Salabanjika.
Yes, the Salabanjika.
I think.
Yeah. Yeah, they're, I mean, you describe them, please.
I believe the official description was they are very, very beautiful women, often found next to or under trees, usually gripping a branch. They're an architectural standby, if you will. They're often seen in sculptures, in general decorations and such like. They are beautiful women described as, and I quote, moon-breasted, swan-waisted, and elephant-hipped, meaning they are incredibly voluptuous. And from the art that has been presented, they are just that. In an oddly respectful sort of way.
Yeah.
It was done very prettily, but it was also not ridiculous.
This is a hallmark. The period they come from is the Dravidian period in Indian history, which
right?
is... before, it's before you have people from, it's before Indo-Europeans migrate into, India.
Okay.
So it's before they had a written language, before you have that kind of stuff added into it.
Right.
And it's also generally considered, when, India as an ethnic pool of people was you know, darker skinned people, more rounded bodies. And you see that in all of the art. Everything's about rounded forms and that kind of stuff.
Which
and,
I personally appreciate.
Yeah.
It's, even sexual overtones aside, I think makes for prettier art in general for me.
Yeah. And definitely, you know, this is... This is a very, very, very old civilization that
yes.
this comes from. So, and they didn't have a written language, so not a lot of it is surviving, sadly.
Sadly. That's something I would love to read more about.
Yes.
But we can't.
Yeah. But definitely the way that it blended with, you know, the Indo-European cultures that migrated to the area that brought things like writing, math concepts, one of the first civilizations to invent indoor plumbing.
Which, thank you so much.
Like the civilization responsible for writing the Vedas and that kind of
right.
stuff. The way that those blended together, you still see Dravidian influences a lot in Buddhism and that kind of stuff. Definitely the roundness of the Buddha.
Oh, that's important.
Yeah. And in fact, specifically with this tree spirit, even though we don't have a lot of surviving stories about them, they are directly the image basis for the Buddha's mother.
Exactly. Supposedly, she was one of them.
Yes.
Which is very cool.
Yeah.
I'm very appreciative of that fact, that they have something they can trace back the lives and the lineage back to. I appreciate that in the god figure.
Yeah.
That brings the actual dryads part to an end, doesn't it?
Yeah, I mean, that's, you know, modern, as far as, like, contemporary terms, dryads are a throwaway female enemy that you'll see, and they'll be
yes.
plant-themed. I can't really think of anything that's really done anything interesting with dryads.
They really haven't.
Yeah.
They haven't.
Yeah.
Like, they're not even canon fodder, they're just sort of there.
You would think even Dragon Age would have a sexy tree encounter in it somewhere.
You would think.
Or The Witcher.
Oh, The Witcher should have.
Yeah.
100%.
I guess the emphasis on Czech culture and Slavic culture in The Witcher probably makes that not really a big thing.
Yeah.
But, like, you know, between The Witcher, Dragon Age, Elder Scrolls, I'd expect somewhere you could fuck a tree, and you can't.
But you can't.
Yeah.
I'm confused and frustrated by
yes.
this. Anyway, as I said, that brings us to an Ent.
Yeah.
And it brings us to the Ents.
Yes. Which, despite having literally no folklore or mythological basis, are what you probably think of when you think of a plant person.
Yes. A gigantic humanoid sort of tree.
Yeah. And actually, the name that Tolkien chose for them is from the Anglo-Saxon word for giant.
Right. Which is accurate.
Yeah, they're big.
They're big. They're trees. And according to Tolkien, they're very slow.
Yes. I remember kind of like trying to block away through, because I loved The Hobbit
right.
when I was a kid. And so I was like, oh, you know, Lord of the Rings is supposed to be the greatest fantasy novel series ever made.
Yay.
I should really try and read it.
Sorry.
I am one of those terrible people that thinks The Lord of the Rings is boring and contains too many passages about describing walking by trees.
That makes two of us.
I have two favorite parts of the Lord of the Rings, and both of them are from the Two Towers. The second one is everything involving the Spider Queen.
That's fair.
I love that spider. I love her. The other one is, despite not liking the long-winded stuff in Lord of the Rings, my favorite part of Lord of the Rings is the super long-winded part where Merry and Pippin talk to a bunch of trees for a long time.
Because it's cool.
Yeah.
And yeah, it lasts a while, but it's something cool.
It's just the way that, you know, Treebeard and the other Ents are presented,
right.
where they're so purposeful and plodding and...
Everything they do takes their time, and they
yeah.
do it for a reason.
And I remember the Ents in you know, the Two Towers movie are great, but I remember I think I started reading Lord of the Rings novels after the first movie came out, but I made sure to read them before the second one came out.
Right.
And man, like, just even just the passages in that book of the Ents, like, you get the feeling of that deep, deep, wonderful baritone.
Right. And that's actually really cool.
Yeah.
And you usually speak of the books and I usually speak of the movies because that's what you have experience in, and the movies are the only ones I have experience in. And I love how they're presented in the movies. Granted, they're taller than they're presented in the books, in the movies.
Whatever.
I like that.
Yeah.
But they're just, they can, Peter Jackson, in his directorial attempts, manages to convey the perfect image of an ent.
Yeah.
It's, visually, it's stunning. Even their movements, everything they do, it's just, that is the one thing he hit absolutely perfect on.
Yeah.
Was the ents and their scenes. Just their assault on the tower. Beautiful, wonderful. It's my favorite part of that movie.
Yeah.
100%. Because it's such a cool battle, and it's just so good.
Yeah. There's, the only thing that I don't like about, that I don't like that didn't get transferred into the movies, is when they do make the attack on Isengard.
Yeah.
Is there's a bunch of tiny little things about the Tree Army that you don't really get. One, it's not just the Ents that go.
Right.
The Ents bring the trees with them.
Yes.
Which is very important. But in addition to that, there are these things that they talk about that they're kind of like Ents. They're definitely sentient. They're not like trees. They're just trees.
Huons.
Yes. The shadow ninja trees that they just see glinting through the tree bodies.
Right.
Like fucking tree ninjas.
It's so cool. They're such a great concept, and yeah, especially because of their origin.
Yeah.
Treebeard says at one point that they are the shepherds of the trees. They keep the trees in line. He also says that shepherds become like sheep, and sheep become like shepherds. So eventually, the two become more similar to each other, and the Huons are the trees becoming more like the tree folk.
Yeah.
And that's such a cool little bit.
And it's, oh man, especially with how plodding the Ents are, and how stationary trees are, to combine them together to get this, like, super fast thing.
Yeah.
Like, it just, it's a very, it creates like a whole nice ecosystem that I feel like is honestly really lacking from most Tolkienic things.
Yes.
It feels like a whole fully realized thing where nothing is too allegorical to anything in particular.
Right. It's just, so many things are very much just like you said, that allegorical.
Yeah.
But that's cool.
I think the fact that Ents are ultimately, they're ultimately a side plot to the rest of Lord of the Rings, allows them to bring in more of that fun comedy and the really good world building that's in The Hobbit.
Yes.
To where it's a very, very nice middle ground between the two.
Yes. Yes. I definitely like that a lot. There's also another thing I found very interesting about the Ents in Tolkien, the Entwives.
Yes.
Whereas the Ents are the shepherds of the trees and nature unbound, the Entwives are the shepherds of agricultural nature, of the things that people use. And they are unfortunately said to have been destroyed or just completely dispersed. But I think it's interesting because the Ents look like they're trees, whereas the Entwives look more like what they guard. They look more like the corn, the flax, the wheat. They're still very plant-like, very big plants and such like that. But they're described as more graceful.
Yeah. I could definitely, like, it's definitely an image that I ran into far after, you know, reading about Entwives and that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
But in, have you seen Ponyo?
Yes, I have.
I kind of imagine Entwives being how Ponyo's mother is in that movie. Mm. A huge, almost textural element that's just, like, you know, an Ent is a tree.
Yes.
But an Entwive could be a whole field of grain.
Oh, that's brilliant.
Yeah.
I like that a lot.
Yeah.
I like that a lot. I'd like to see that at some point.
Yeah, and just when you interact with the Entwive, it's just the way that it moves is how it responds to you. And you might hear that echoing voice from it as, you know, the grain is moved in a certain way by the wind that you think you see a mouth moving. Like,
yeah.
I feel like that could just be a very beautiful, like, awe-inspiring image.
Right, right. I can't help but think of the Amber Waves of Grain line right now.
Yeah. yeah. Oh, Entwives. Very American.
Oh, totally.
Yeah.
If there's any American monster, that's it.
that and Eagle People.
Entwives, Aarakocca, and let's say like mountain trolls.
Yeah.
Because mountains in America.
And buffaloes. Not buffalo men or like just buffalo. Just straight
dire,
up buffaloes.
Dire buffalo men.
Dire buffaloes.
All right. I think we've discovered the America.
Yeah. Oh man. Other Ent stuff though. You've got the tree in Harry Potter. He's cool.
You do have the Whomping Willow.
Yeah.
Which has a relation back to Tolkien, Old Man Willow.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
I never made that connection.
Yeah. Yeah, Old Man Willow was just a big, angry willow tree from the dawn of time.
Yeah.
Who basically tries to put the hobbits to sleep. It's not shown in the movie, but it's in the books.
Yeah.
And he almost does it, except for Sam, who is the only sane one, as per usual.
That's from Lord. That's from the Fellowship, right?
Yes, I believe so.
Yeah, I only read half of the Fellowship because I got so bored with it.
That's fair.
That is probably like, if there's any reason to take away like my nerd cred card, it's that I never actually read all of the Fellowship of the Ring. I skipped half of it.
It's all right. I've forgotten most of it. But yes, Old Man Willow. He's not, you know, Whomping Willow kind of thing. He's not going to run around and hit everything that comes in. He's not destroying any flying cars.
Yeah.
But he tries to put the hobbits to sleep, and he almost drowns Frodo.
Here's the thing. Let's assume, as we are led to believe, that The Lord of the Rings takes place during European prehistory.
No.
If Old Man Willow was around for another 4,000 years... I'm pretty sure that he would be angry enough at that point that he would beat up a car.
You're right. You're right. I think we have a little anchor here. We have a little connection.
Yeah.
I like that a lot.
It's the oldest, angriest old man who is also a tree.
Right? Right?
He wants you to get off his roots.
Exactly it. And I mean, I imagine he'd be incredibly pissed off because obviously the rest of his forest has been cut down and replaced it with this stupid castle for stupid human children.
Yeah.
Yeah. He'd be pretty PO'd.
Yeah. Other Ents, or tree Ents as they're often called to avoid copyright infringement.
Right.
Basically just tree monsters in games.
Anything you see that's just a walking tree is probably a tree Ent.
Yeah. Anything from the stumps in MapleStory to... the full-sized tree monsters in any given RPG.
Right, exactly. So that's them.
Again, I can't think of a modern game that has I guess Golden Sun, the first one, has an angered tree spirit as an early dungeon that's plot important and like, has a thing. And that was kind of fun, but like I'd like to see more stuff done with tree characters.
Kirby!
You do fight a fucking living tree in Kirby.
Right, he throws apples at you and he blows you around and he's kind of mean, but then you basically kick his butt and he's like, sorry.
So we've got two tree characters in all of modern fantasy.
Right, right.
We need more, give me more trees.
Please do.
Give me more trees. I love a tree. Do you know there's a tree called Purple Heart?
No, I didn't.
So, so trees basically have two different kinds of wood. You've got the outer wood, and then you've got heartwood.
Right.
Generally, they're pretty much exactly the same.
Yeah.
In certain kinds of trees, you'll get color differentiations. Generally, the heart's a little bit lighter than the outside meat of the tree.
Makes sense.
All of it's dead, though. Like, the important thing to remember about an actual real-life physical tree is that the couple of centimeters in from the bark is the only part of the tree that's actually alive.
Yeah.
But... you have this particular kind of tree called Purple Heart. And the outside wood is your typical tree color, maybe a little dark. But the inside is this beautiful, actual purple color. Like
a royal purple?
People can't see it, right? But like that center flower right there, that purple.
Oh, wow. That's actually very pretty. It's a sort of lightish, almost ashy purple.
Yeah. Like, it's almost like... not as dark as, like, an eggplant purple, but not as faded as a lavender either, like, halfway between those two things.
Oh, that's very nice.
Yeah. I had a friend in college who made a penguin out of it, and it was
That's
great.
Cool.
Yeah, he did, I want to say he did the beak and the stomach out of pine, but the rest of it was Purple Heart.
I like that a lot.
Yeah.
That sounds very pretty.
Yeah. Oh man, it was, I love Purple Heart. But yeah, moving on to other plants.
Speaking of organs and wood.
Yeah, we've got mandragoras and mandrakes.
Right.
Yeah. So there's a lot of different parallel things that kind of combine into what this is.
Yeah. It's pretty diverse.
Yeah. Things in, like, actual plants in the mandrake and mandragora families are...
Narcotic and hallucinogenic.
Yes. They do crazy shit. So obviously, you know, in old homeopathy and medicine, they get used for things that are supposed to heal you. Because right. they're narcotic and hallucinogenic.
They're basically a go-to sedative.
Yes.
For anyone who can't do alcohol, they do mandrakes.
Yeah. And a thing that led to the name was there was kind of like a myth that, you know, certain mandrake roots would grow roots that were humanoid in shape or like babies.
Indeed. And you see that with other plants as well. Yeah. Example, ginger.
Yes. Whereas sometimes they have the knobby bits. Yeah, and sometimes they'll look like people.
Yeah, and I think it's sometimes funny the things you can do with that.
Yeah, and while this is probably in the most abstract sense they look like people, oftentimes in, you know, fantasy images, they will literally look like people or fetuses.
Yes. Babies is a very common image for mandrakes.
In Harry Potter, like, they're literally, you pull it out of the ground and it's a crying, screaming baby.
Right, and the cry is oftentimes lethal.
Yes. The origin of how you make mandrakes that have...
Which one?
The most... Generally, you have a gallows, mm-hmm. and you hang people there.
Right.
And in more PC versions of the story, it's blood from the dead body.
Of course.
More commonly, during the period that this is going on, it's, you know, when you hang a guy, sometimes...
Their body evacuates.
Yeah.
Everything.
Yeah, they ejaculate a bit. And if their seed hits a plant, it can somehow impregnate the plant, and the plant will grow a mandragora.
Talk about gallows humors.
Yep. So yeah, technically Bacchus and Dionysus are mandrakes.
This is true.
Yeah.
This is 100% true.
Yeah. They're creepy.
Yes.
Yeah.
I mean, if their initial design doesn't creep you out, their origin will do it. Because, I mean, honestly, just this screaming, dirty baby that you pull out of the ground? Yeah, no.
Yeah.
Let's not.
Yeah. In like, you know, classic Castlevania, Persona, Shin Megami Tensei-style art, you know, while you'll have ints that are just big old scary-looking trees and dryads right. that are sexy tree ladies, right. mandragoras will be these creepy little plant goblins.
Yes. And they're legitimately terrifying.
Yeah.
Like, let's look at this. Let's look at this objectively here. You have this little dirty baby thing running at you with a plant on top of its head, and it's got tendrils coming out of its arms and fingers, and it's trailing dirt and roots. No, that's the stuff of nightmares. That is this thing you see coming down your hallway, and you don't kick it as you should. You think you would just kick it and run away. No, no. You turn, you run, you lock your door, and you wait for it to go away. If it does. At which point it starts burrowing under your door, and you're screwed. Terrifying.
There is another thing for an origin for what mandragoras and mandrakes are.
Yes.
As kind of a separate thing that probably led into the idea of reinforcing the idea that the roots are people things.
Yeah.
A mandragora was also a term used to give as a wooden... kind of doll, a wooden humanoid doll that Satan would give a sorcerer upon pledging their soul to Satan for them to, you know, cast spells through and that kind of thing.
Sounds.
And there is a play that's supposedly a true account of investigating a sorcerer where in order to destroy any evidence that he was casting spells, he took his mandragora and threw it into the fire so it burnt up and burnt up any evidence that he was a spellcaster.
I mean, honestly, that makes sense.
Yeah.
There's supposedly spells in which to turn wooden things into homunculi.
Yeah.
It's complicated and you have to drown bats and...
Yeah.
Yeah, nah.
Definitely, mandragoras and mandrakes are tied up in a lot of different alchemical folklore and a lot of different homunculi folklore and all of that weird 15th century magic rigmarole that goes around.
Right, right. It's very alchemically tied. There are parts of it used even in Japanese adaptations, usually with Western influences, such as Haunting Grounds. I believe there are a few mentions of it in Resident Evil alongside the plant monster subject 47, I want to say.
Mm-hmm.
That series uses plants very well.
Yeah. Castlevania is the thing I'm surprised we haven't talked about until this episode. But it makes sense that this is the episode it comes up to.
Right. I mean, we haven't covered anything that it covers yet.
I guess, yeah. It's most, like, when I think of it, it's mostly undead, but...
Yeah, it's we've got undead, we've got vampires.
It's weird that none of the monsters we've talked to... I'm sure goblins or kobolds were in a Castlevania, but I'm not sure to a big degree.
Little gobos, yeah.
Yeah, it's just weird that nothing else that we've talked about until Triads is a major monster in...
For such a wide variety of things that show up, there's not a wide variety of things that show up.
Yeah.
It's odd. But yes, it's good that it finally came up,
yeah.
Because that one's had a lot of influence on how a lot of people see monsters.
Yes, definitely the between Castlevania and Shin Megami Tensei, those are probably two of the biggest unknown influences on fantasy art.
Right.
From Mandragoras, we get Aurons.
Yes, literally.
Yes, which ostensibly are the children of a witch that breeds with the mandrake root.
Right. Which is really, 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 really creepy.
Yeah. And like, oh man, this is one of the more interesting like things we've come across in researching things.
Yep.
Because definitely the idea of this existed before the name Auron got put to it.
Yes.
But the name got put to it because of this play in 1911 where someone, a scientist, a mad scientist, looks at the concept of mandrakes.
Right.
And the idea that, a witch would breed with him and that kind of thing. Or that, you know, you could, what would happen if you impregnated someone with the seed of a criminal.
Right. The whole thing explores themes of artificial insemination, how yeah. it would affect someone's morality.
Yeah. And basically inseminates this woman unbeknownst to her with the seed of a mass murderer.
Right.
And the resulting child, much how an Allrain would be, had no concept of love or fealty and was
only
soulless.
Obsessive lust.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Definitely highly influenced by, crazy Christian morality myth and what
yeah.
have you.
Yeah.
But
I think this was like, what, 1910, 1912?
1911.
There we are.
Yeah. But easily, like, I wouldn't be surprised if it was from the 1850s or anything either.
Or even a little earlier, to be yeah. completely honest.
I mean, if it was from the Baroque period, it would definitely involve someone being lit on fire.
Granted.
But yeah, out of all of this, we did get the Castlevania enemy of the same name, which is...
Auron.
Yeah, Auron, which is, it's a flower with a naked lady popping out of it.
Yeah, I mean, it's basically like, what's the name of that one? It's not the Venus flytrap. It's the something pot? Honey pot?
Pitcher plants. They're
pitcher
called
plants.
Pitcher plants.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Pitcher perfect. Because that's what I always see Allrune, like, used, what their basis is.
Yeah, like, definitely they seem like a plant-themed succubus kind of
essentially,
creature.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's especially with the emphasis on suck there.
I really do like their designs because it uses plant imagery in a kind of like mimic high fashion ball gowns and that kind of stuff, which
yes.
is an interesting thing. And it definitely, I like to call it the Pokemon with clothes thing.
Yeah.
That I really don't like in a lot of fantasy design where there are items that are just kind of added on and it's like this... Ostensibly, this is a part of the creature that's their flesh,
right.
but it looks like an accessory that they put on themselves.
Yes.
And Allrons pretty much have a pretty good track record for, all right, this is supposed to resemble hair, but it still looks like a thing and naturally the plant creature would grow or
right.
something like that.
Which is very cool.
Yeah.
I love the concept of Allrons, honestly. But yeah,
yeah.
that's Allrons.
Yeah.
There's not a whole lot behind them, but they have a lot of things that have sprung from them.
Yeah. Definitely, you know, ostensibly, we will be covering this soon. Monster Musume has an Auron in it.
Also has a Dryad.
Oh, I didn't realize it had both.
Yes.
Huh.
Yep, it's got ki. Literally the word for tree.
Yeah.
Just for those of you who didn't, you know.
Who don't
feel bad.
Yeah.
Please don't. I feel bad for knowing it.
Some other plant monsters.
other plants.
Yeah, we've got the generic giant Venus flytrap man-eating plant. We have Audrey 2 from Little Pet Shop of Horrors and Cleopatra from the Addams Family.
Right, right. Yeah. All very good.
Yeah, which, yeah, big old chomping mouthy plant.
I like Audrey from Little Shop of Horrors. He's just clever. You know, he's got the whole singing thing going for him. I mean, honestly, there's a reason Noel Bard. I like the music. And he's obviously a very musically talented plant. That's really cool.
Yeah. I don't know.
Also, he ate a dentist.
When I first started playing Magic, I was a bit of a Timmy, which is why I played green. And so I had big old monsters. But yeah. After I got out of the, I'm going to play four scaled worms in a deck
of course.
Phase, two of my favorite cards was I had a Llanowar Dryad.
Very
which
cool.
was a pretty simple card that just had Forest Walk, and it was a tree lady. It was a lady coming out of a tree made out of bark. And then I had a wall just called Carnivorous Plants, and it was a little bit of dirt with just a bunch of just snapping mouth thorny vined plants on top of each
That's
other.
That's awesome.
Those are two of my favorite cards.
I've never seen that one, but I love it already.
Oh, man, it's that first set. It was from the first set.
We got to put that in the queue. What else do we have?
One of my favorite fantasy authors ever, Chinna Mieville, and his Cacticae. Basically, Chinna Mieville has a series of novels that I like to describe as adventure punk. They take the idea of the kind of world that would have to exist where your typical D&D party would actually exist, where, you know, generally his stories will take place in a metropolitan area,
mm-hmm.
And explicitly, adventurers showing up is a bad thing.
Yeah.
Because they are murder hobos that are there to disrupt the economy and will probably kill some people.
Yeah, that's not inaccurate at all.
Yeah, and he has a particular setting, which supposedly his home D&D game is run out of.
Mm-hmm.
That he's done a number of novels in. The most well-known one, it's a giant train city that just moves across the world.
So, Snowpiercer.
The Cacticae are giant saguaro cactus people.
I like it.
They are well-known for being very hardy, because they have the biology of a cactus.
Yes.
A bullet will pass through them, and that's one of the few things that can make it through their tough, thick hide.
Yeah.
And if the bullet passes through them, well, so what? Like, they don't really have major organs.
They're just going to leak a bit.
Yes, they'll leak a bit. They'll be okay. They'll patch it up. So you want to know what the cacti's go-to weapon is to fight other cacti.
Please tell me.
It's a crossbow that fires buzzsaws.
Oh my god, that's beautiful.
Because it will just lop whole pieces of them off.
That's brilliant.
It is. Oh man, I love Chinna Mieville. Please, Just go find a Chinna Mieville book. If you don't, I don't know why you're listening to this, if you don't like fantasy, but if you don't like fantasy, A Brief Wondrous Life of Oscar Wilde is like one of my favorite novels ever by him. It's great. Oh, man. Cacti are real cool.
They are. Yeah. Which brings us to our next monster. Cactars.
Yeah, cactars. Also, cactuses. They have at least 1,000 needles per cactus.
Generally, yeah. Usually more, because they can use it more than once, even if the first doesn't do the job.
Yeah, they run away real fast.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they're actually very fast.
Yeah.
For cactuses, they're real fast. For something that's, you know, slow growing.
Lot of sales to them besides that.
Yeah, they got funny faces. They're always doing the funny dance, and they run without moving.
Yeah.
And they're cool. I like them.
Yeah.
And one of my personal favorite recent monsters.
Yeah.
Flowey the Flower.
I know nothing about Flowey except that it will... It's kind of the breaking point for Undertale when you realize that it actually is hard.
Yes. Flowey the Flower is exactly that. He's a flower. He's literally a yellow flower with a smiley face in the middle.
Yeah.
And if you haven't played Undertale, go play it. Pause this. Go look it up because I'm going to spoil a little tiny bit. He's an asshole. Flowey is a tremendous asshole. He's one of few people in the whole game to curse, and it just emphasizes how big of a tremendous asshole he is. He's the most horrible social Darwinist there is ever.
Yeah.
And it's He's a shitty, shitty person. But there's a damn good reason for it that I'm not going to ruin for you. Let it be known that he's a plant, and let it be known that he can be absolutely terrifying. He's legitimately one of those fear moments in the game, repeatedly. And it's real cool. I loved Undertale, just all of it together, but Flowey was really one of the coolest elements. But yes, that's one of my favorite recent plant monsters. And there's just something about him that's great.
Yeah. My number one plant monster of all time, Pikmin.
Pikmin.
I love Pikmin. They're so cute.
They are. They're great.
Yeah. And like, you know, they get little leaves and they turn into buds and then flowers. And
it's
you
so
got,
cute.
You got little nosy red Pikmin, and you got bigger eared yellow Pikmin.
Yep.
And you got gilled blue Pikmin and big old fat
purple Pikmin.
And you got poisonous white Pikmin. I love Pikmin. Oh my God.
And I mean, it strikes like all of the good parts in me.
Yeah.
It's like you got little tiny cute guys that follow you around and obey you to their deaths, at which point their souls go up and you're like, oh God, no, I just wasted all my Pikmin. And then they're color-coded.
And they do have souls. It is proven in-game they have souls.
Yes, they do, because you see them and it makes you feel horrible.
Yes.
I think I'm going to cry a little. I like that game.
The one thing that I've always, and obviously, you know, it's a video game. It can't, sometimes you have to make little cuts here and there. But trying to quantify what exactly Pikmin eat, because basically you use the big tablets to create Pikmin.
Yes.
Which ostensibly I'm going to assume is Pikmin food or Pikmin fertilizer or something like that.
Yeah. I'm pretty sure it's just basic, like, elements of what they need.
But, like, you can get them from, like, flowers... From, like, the flower heads, so, like, ostensibly it's, like, pollen and seeds and that kind of stuff. But then also you can get them from bugs you kill.
Uh-huh.
So it's just kind of like, Pikmin are these incredible omnivorous things. Like, they don't actually need to eat while they're alive.
Right, but they need it to make themselves.
Yeah, it's like a weird, like, soup thing. But I guess that's combined with, you know, the little Pikmin pot things. So maybe Pikmin aren't even a natural... organism. Maybe there's something alien.
I mean, it makes sense, because you're an alien to the planet that you land on.
Yeah.
So it makes sense.
Yeah.
And I mean, maybe they just don't need to eat because they die so quick.
Yeah, that's true.
Like, there's no need for them to eat. They need no nutrients. They just have what they carry.
Maybe, oh man, I mean, because like, whenever you finish, like, you know, maybe you might be playing for what, I guess like 3 days is a general cycle before you like lose or whatever.
I believe it was 28 days.
Oh, yeah, yeah. You have a certain amount of days. But generally, you know, you go back to the little pot every night.
Yeah, because you have to get out there before night falls.
Yes. So I guess maybe the little pots have their food storage or whatever.
Could be. And I mean, they serve... Because remember, they die if they're not planted, if I recall correctly.
That's true, yeah.
But overnight, if they're planted, they survive. So I assume that while they're... there at night, they absorb their nutrients from the area surrounding.
I'm going to assume that they mostly feed on nitrogen then. Because then you're just kind of, you're fertilizing them with dead matter, basically.
Which explains why they only survive once they're planted, after you go in, after the day has ended, because it's nitrogen.
Get out of my house.
Okay.
Maybe they feed on like yeast or something, I don't know. Yeah.
Wouldn't surprise me.
Yeah. Pikmin.
I love Pikmin.
Pikmin are cute. Oh, they're great.
They really are. Oh my
Pikmin.
God.
If you've been hearing my ice cubes clink the whole night, the drink of the night for dryads is a gin and tonic.
Right.
Gin is made from juniper berries. Juniper berries are from juniper trees. Trees are dryads. Yeah.
Appropriate.
Yeah.
So basically he's drinking dryad berry.
Yeah.
I like that.
Well, also the Jack's small batch elderberry tonic for it.
Even better.
Yeah.
Even better.
Just all kinds of berries and trees. I wish I had some oak chips I could have aged it in.
Ah, that would have been great. But sadly, it's not to be. But yeah, that's dryads.
Yeah. And also Ents and Mandragoras and Alruns.
Yes, yes. We covered a lot.
Yeah.
It's kind of impressive, actually.
Yeah. So dryads.
What can we do with dryads?
Like, even, let's you know, not discount their ability to move about. Let's not say that they're absolutely grounded to one specific spot.
Right.
But I still like them not being very mobile.
Right. They generally have one patch of land that they stick to.
Yeah.
And they will defend like nobody's business.
Yeah.
With, I don't know, a wall of carnivorous plants, maybe.
Maybe. Or just, you know, staunch perseverance.
Yep, yep. I feel like they're one of the few races that we've covered that are truly going to be territorial as hell.
Yes. And I'm sure they're willing to share their space with other creatures and other people and what have you.
As long as they're respectful.
Yes.
Because that's a big part of Dryadic mythology.
Yeah.
Is they're okay as long as you're respectful.
Yeah.
You know, you don't go peeing on their home tree. That's going to get you wrecked real quick.
Yeah.
But like, you know, as long as you keep it to a stream downstream, you're going to be fine.
Yeah. I could even see just a very, very placable dryad even be okay with you maybe chopping down a few trees just to make a spot for you to build a house or something.
Right, because they understand that mortals, in the common sense, don't, you know, live out in the open air like they do.
Yeah, and even then, you know, clearing out old wood is a good thing for forests.
Exactly, because you can't just have consistent, you know, old stuff everywhere.
Yeah.
You got to get rid of it for the new. And as long as you plant something, I imagine there'd be a sort of equivalent exchange thing going on here.
Yes. Oh, man.
I imagine that dryads would have a sort of country of their own, not in a political sense, but in a geographical sense.
Yes.
They would have an area where they live.
There would definitely be sections of country that are primarily inhabited by dryads.
Right. And certainly there would be other people to live with them, too. I'm not saying it would be completely dryad-controlled. I don't think they would have an interest in control, really.
Yeah.
I think they would have just an interest in living and in seeing what goes on around them. I think they would accept other people to come live with them. They would even encourage people from other cultures and stuff to come live with them, maybe so they could document it. Maybe they're interested in that sort of thing. Maybe they have an incredibly long memory, as trees are wont to do. But I think I think they'd like people to live with them as long as they were respectful.
It definitely reminds me of a certain end of tribal culture that we've never really talked about thus far in the more realistic sense of once you remove historical narratives of, and this tribe conquered this tribe and this nation subjugated this culture and that
of course,
kind of thing.
Because that's all people do is war.
Yeah. That until you get to a certain point where government is needed for society to interconnect and interplay with each other, a tribe is really just a bunch of people who live in a similar area who share a similar culture.
Right.
And I feel like that's how dryads would be.
Right.
You know, the only form of government they might have would be like the Entmoot in Lord of the Rings, where it's literally all of the dryads or ants or whatever getting together to discuss something that affects their community as a whole.
Everyone who can move goes to it.
Yeah.
Those who don't send in little notes or ideas with the people who can. Because I imagine it would be a very interconnected kind of thing.
Yeah.
Because assuming that all the plant folk generally could work together if they were interested in it, and not always necessarily true, because there is interspecies competition within plants. If all biology sees that, and it's actually what drives so much diversity between plants. But assuming that sentient plants would generally work together, given that, you know, everything else is not plant.
Yeah.
It would be an interesting thing to see how connected they could become. Because, like, hamadryads, being unable to move, would send their thoughts with the dryads who could.
Yeah.
Or they'd perhaps send a messenger who could record their thoughts, perhaps a little mandrake.
Yeah. Or, you know, the huge million-year-old tree that's probably too big and rooted down to really move about all that much would send one of the neighboring trees with its wise opinions on the matter.
Right, right. Or perhaps that would be where the moot's held.
Yeah.
Because that would be an interesting thing. Under the bough of this tremendous tree the size of a small city.
Yeah. But there are species of tree that are called multiple-stem trees, and also there are technically clone colony trees.
Right.
Where because the way that the tree propagates and the way that the roots and other bits of it interconnect, that essentially what you would see is, oh, well, that's a tree and that's a tree and that's a tree, are actually all interconnected bodies of the same organism that could span up to an acre to 5 square miles.
It's kind of like that one tremendous mushroom that they have in that one town in the U.S.
Yes.
I like that. I like that for trees.
Imagine that as a single dryad.
Yeah, just imagine hearing the same voice from like 20 different directions.
Yeah, even if it's a hamadryad, just this one spirit who can move from all the particular bodies of this tree.
Right, it just sort of disappears from one point and shows up in another.
Yeah.
Kind of like Forest Walk.
Exactly. And then as kind of like a contrast to that, Mandragoras and Aurons are something I would see very much happening more in an urban setting.
Yes.
Where they're a plant population that definitely has ties to an older, you know, dryad or ant population, but are significantly intermarried with whatever the local humanoid is.
Yeah.
And while they do make themselves distinct as a culture, are still very much a part of whatever city or nation or grouping that they're a part of.
I imagine them being... Well, I imagine Mandragoras in this case, because they're always babies.
Yeah.
They're always small, tiny people. I imagine them being considered almost something less than sentient, even if they're not actually. So I imagine them being very ignored.
Yeah.
Almost like, you know, like pigeons or birds are in the city. They're just kind of there.
Yeah.
But they're actually smart.
Or how orphan street children would be treated in, like, around the turn of the century.
Then. Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. You've got some Dickens-esque thing going on.
Yeah. Permanently Dickens-esque race of tree people.
they've got that stupid hat and everything.
Yes.
Oh, my God. That's a horror story just thinking about it right there.
They'd probably get along really, really well with kobolds.
Oh, yeah, definitely. I'd say the two would work together very well in an urban setting.
I'm trying to think of whether or not they would wear clothes or not. And it's just kind of... There are points where they would probably want clothing.
Yeah.
Not necessarily in the dead of winter, because at that point they're going to change their physiology to be able to deal with it. But around the times of like first frost and that kind of thing, they'll want clothes.
Just so they can get adjusted.
Yeah.
Right.
And then in the heat of summer, they'll also want clothes because...
They don't want to get fried.
Yeah, they don't want to get literally have the moisture boiled out of their skin.
Yeah, and that makes sense.
Yeah. Because, you know, they don't sweat or anything. They don't have a way to get rid of heat.
Right. It just sort of stays there.
I think that's an interesting thing to think about, the way that it'll affect their everyday, you know, happenstance, is they will have biological reactions to the different seasons.
Yes.
But they will happen, they'll be big changes.
Yeah.
But there'll be big changes that happen over a long period of time. Like as they gradually shift from a chlorophyll fueled diet, unless they're an evergreen dryad or mandragora or whatever, to supplanting that with other forms of energy. But, you know, how will they deal with that in the meantime when they're earning 50-50 of each? Or when they're getting ready to winter, like as their body hardens and they start storing water in different ways.
Yeah.
You know, well, they've still got to deal with those extreme frosts that are going to happen at the end of fall or the beginning of spring.
Like, yeah.
You know, but they're not equipped to deal with it. Well, what are they going to do? Well, I guess they'll throw like a cloak on or something. So it'll be
kind of like grabbing a palm tree.
Yeah.
Hmm.
Like sort of the majority of the year, they'll seem the same.
Yeah.
But there'll just be, maybe they'll even have like kind of religious holidays or festivals around particular times of year where they have to do certain things while their body changes.
Yeah. Like a festival of cloak weaving or something.
Yeah.
That'd be interesting.
Definitely, since they are fairly sedentary, I feel like this is one of the first races where we have a very, very, and because of their association with plant life, this is probably the first time where we've had a plant that we could definitely say, yes, they are going to farm for sustenance.
100%.
Yeah.
They're going to farm, and what they don't farm, they're going to get from the people living with them as compost.
Yes. Which, they're definitely going to farm a lot of beans and legumes and that kind of thing.
Out nitrogen fixtures.
Because, again, they need nitrogen. That's a very important part to their structure.
Yeah. And I think out of anyone, like any race at all, they will understand the crop and the harvest the absolute best.
Yes.
If not only because of their plant relationship to them, but perhaps because of Entwives or something.
Yeah.
It's just something that they have a connection with.
Yeah.
Which brings up the thought of carnivorous plants.
Yeah.
I imagine Aurons as being largely carnivorous, honestly.
Yeah.
When I see them, because like I said, the pitcher plants, I can see them associating with Venus flytraps, with any sort of carnivorous plant.
And the crazy thing about carnivorous plants is they still do all the processes that normal plants do.
Right.
It's just they have to obtain certain minerals in certain ways, and that's a way that they can do that.
Right, because the ground they're in doesn't have those minerals. But the plants, or not the plants, but the animals around them do. So they learn to digest that. So I think that would be an interesting regional thing.
Yeah.
It's certain places Aurons arise just because of the soil around them. Certain places they arise simply because, well, the abundance of prey.
Yeah.
In certain places it's because magical bullshit happened.
Yeah. I also think that's an interesting thing to approach as far as like modern concepts of race and that kind of thing. You know, an ash ant or dryad is different than an oak ant or dryad.
Right.
You know, a lily Aurun is different than an orchid Aurun.
Right.
Like they, you could definitely play up the differences in species and that kind of thing, because you know definitely you'll have areas that are mixed with different kinds of trees and
certainly
flowers and what have you. But then you'll also have
predominantly pine areas.
Yeah, like there are a lot of mixed deciduous forests in Virginia, and there are a lot of forests that are nothing but oak trees.
Right.
There are sections of, you know, the northern and southern hemisphere that are nothing but evergreen, and generally they're one or two different kinds of evergreen tree.
Yep, yep. And that's definitely something you could play up as something very different, because, yeah, there's a lot of, you know, racism between the non-plant races. Why wouldn't there be between the plants?
Yeah. And I think definitely finding a way to play up local culture.
Yes.
Since they're going to be highly sedentary creatures, that the rare instance that they do move about and they meet a different plant monster. And even if, it's just the difference between a red oak and a white oak.
Yeah.
Any difference they perceive in that other creature, they're going to amount, oh, it's because they're this kind of tree.
Right.
Yeah.
And just imagine how many faux pas could be, like, how many times a faux pas could occur just because of that?
Yeah.
They just don't understand that it's different for them.
Yeah.
Because they are generally perceived as very slow in everything.
Like, you could definitely play up sort of a stubbornness, almost to an insensitivity, where they're the kind of race where even if they're not necessarily that long-lived, they're going to treat any human, they're going to refer to a human by their family name because, oh, well, you're not going to be around that long. All humans are the same. All humans of your family are the same.
Right, yeah. Right. Even if they're wildly different and they show it, it's still not going to be accepted for a long time.
Yes.
Among the long-lived plants. For things, I imagine, like Mandragora or for possibly Aurons, I imagine they could adjust pretty well.
That does bring up what if you have a perennial Aurun?
Mm-hmm.
An Aurun that lives and dies in the span of a year.
Yeah. Yep. Oh, man.
That you could have a very similar thing in that, you know, things might change in small amounts, but mostly what they're going to get is from whoever teaches them when they wake up. So there might be a very strong, stubborn tradition among them. And that it's being passed over in very, very short cycles.
Right.
And you might end up with a telephone effect where that gradually changes into something different. But
very
they're going
quickly.
To, yeah. If you're alive for 12 months, 8 months maybe, you know, you're going, you're told something, this is true now, and it's going to be true when you die not too long from now, you're going to stick to that.
Generally, yes.
Yeah.
That also brings up the idea of annuals. Like things, they're here. And then they're gone for a little while, then they're back.
Yeah.
They're gone for a little bit, and they're back.
They simply don't have, like, they you know, an annual that is, you know, hibernates for 6 months out of the year.
Yeah.
And literally, you know, they hear about this winter festival, but they have no concept of it because they have no concept of winter because they wither and sleep for that entire time.
Right. Exactly. There's so much you can do with plants.
Yeah.
Plants are such a wild, untapped idea. Vines. Just imagine an urban setting in which, you know, you always see the whole nature takes its own back and all that. You see stuff popping up through cracks and vines taking over buildings. But imagine if that was one plant creature.
Yeah.
Just imagine what you could do with that. You could repurpose the whole building and have them run whatever it is you're doing.
Yeah.
Or it could be a horror show. It could be something absolutely terrifying. No one goes to that building because no one comes out of it.
Yeah.
Ever. Because, well, the building needs to eat. And it's not the building itself. It's what owns it.
Here's something that's going to sound a little controversial when I say it. I think that they are actually going to be very good at and very appreciative of metalwork and jewelry work. Because any kind of fibrous kind of thing,
mm-hmm.
like, yes, it's going to help them in those specific periods that we talked about, but it's going to decay very quickly. There's right. going to be whole sections where they're not going to use it.
Yes.
Whereas, you know, a gold necklace, one, is going to stand the test of time.
Yes.
Two, they're going to be able to appreciate it. And three, despite the fact that plant monsters are always weak to fire,
mm-hmm.
Wood is actually harder to burn than most human or animal flesh.
Granted.
That definitely when you have something as, you know, an Alron or a Mandragora, since they're much more closer to, you know, vegetation and fruits and flowers and that kind of thing, but it probably wouldn't be working with fire. But I don't see any reason why an ant would actually be scared of fire.
I don't think it would be scared so much as just avoidant, because on the off chance that it happens, it's probably going to burn down.
That's the thing. An actual living tree is so filled with water.
True.
I mean, for that matter, dry wood is harder to light a flame than one, you know, an animal living body. I feel the hesitance with fire that an ant would be the same that the hesitance of fire that you and I would have. You know, obviously you don't want your leaves to get set afire, just right. like you wouldn't want your hair to get set afire, because right. that's annoying and it might light your whole head up.
Yeah.
But on the whole, you know, you or I aren't scared to light a gas stove or anything.
Granted.
Yeah. And they would definitely have protective means when they were working with that, just yeah. like you or I would.
Yeah, they'd have water or some sort of extinguisher.
Yeah, or, you know, they'd make oven mitts or you know, that kind of thing. But I don't think the idea that an ant would work with fire is as crazy and out there as it's often presented.
And that might be an interesting point for non-plants to try and, for them to try and explain to non-plants. It's like, yes, you use wood for your fires because it burns for a long time.
Yeah.
But it doesn't blight instantly, does it?
Yeah.
Well, no.
You might even have an evil tree that uses people for firewood.
I mean, that's a thing. That could be a thing.
Yeah. Which, you know, if they are, you know, you might have, because, you know, they're probably going to be hesitant to burn trees.
Yes.
Trees are their people.
It's like we don't burn people.
But they're not going to be hesitant to burn coal. And if you have some ancient, deeply rooted tree that can pull coal up whenever it wants, it might be like the legendary swordsmith for your setting.
That's very clever.
Because it can pull coal, it can pull ore, rocks to build a furnace out of, just right out of the ground. Because
it has like hundreds of little tentacles under it.
Yeah.
It's just the most automatic mining process ever.
Yeah.
And it just pulls up anything solid and sort of sorts it out. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's very right.
And it can break anything up. It doesn't matter if that gem is in the middle of a giant boulder. Eventually, it'll get to it.
Because that's the thing. It's said that Ents in Tolkien's universe are very good at breaking down rock.
Yeah.
They're very good at handling it. They can rip and tear rocks apart. That's a very, very astute one there.
This is another one of the, like, I like them as being very culturally unified, but independent.
Yes.
And I feel like that makes them a cool thing to put an Ent or a dryad in the middle of your castle. To have that be a central big figure to this culture of other things, where it's kind of bringing its own thing to this area because it's been there for forever and it's kind of built up around them.
Right, right. And imagine one that actually takes interest in the history and what's happened. Imagine them as being, you know, your sage or your librarian or whatnot.
Yeah.
That'd be really cool.
Yeah.
I mean, great, it'd be like working with books bound in leather, but I mean, let's be honest. That's not uncommon.
Yeah. And then as kind of like an opposite thing, I kind of really like Mandragoras and Alroyans as a way to you know, bring modern ideas of like youth culture into a fantasy setting where right. you have this these creatures that have such a high turnover rate. You know, it's not that they're growing into adults and entering society. It's just that's the part they occupy. You have, you know, a bunch of punk rock Aurons or, yeah. you know, like we said earlier, Mandragora street children or something. Yeah. And they kind of keep alive this weird counterculture because they, you know, very much they are born and bred from the society that they're in.
Right.
But the fact that they're so like, you know, even like orcs or Rakshasa or whatever are going to be so different than a plant creature that they immediately have this really easy way to insert a counter perspective to the society that you have.
Right. And they don't have time to like grow and mature.
Yeah.
Like they don't have time to experience enough that they mature and see things the way that, you know, an ent or an old dryad would.
Yeah.
Hey, would. No, but they understand things in a very quick, very basic way. And sure, there are some that show a little more maturity and such like than others, because that's just naturally how it is. Some people are a little more elevated in that level than others.
Yeah.
But on the whole, they're generally very much the youth, as you said. I like that.
Yeah.
I think there's so very much you can do with plant creatures that is just completely untapped. Even more so than anything else we've covered in the prior, what? Eight episodes? Nine episodes?
Nine.
In the prior nine episodes, there's so much that's left untapped about plants. There's nothing that matches how much you have available at your own fingertips.
Yeah. It's such an alien concept from taking a plant and making it sentient that it just gives you a lot of free rein to try new things.
Right. It really does. You can do anything you want with plants. You can make them caring and loving and helpful. You can make them absolutely alien and terrifying and sadistic. You can do whatever you want with them, and it will fit because there is a plant to match your idea.
Yeah. One thing I would, like, if, you know, obviously we want questions about whatever we're doing next, which we'll go over in a bit. But if what I would love to hear ideas about is, you know, as far as we've been talking about Mandragoras and Aurons, they're dependent on another species.
Yes.
And generally the way it's been brought up is a humanoid species. Species with blood or whatever.
Yeah.
I would like to hear everyone's ideas about an inter dryad community that somehow through their own death creates Mandragoras and Aurons to then be Mandragoras and Aurons for an inter dryad community where you have this society of upstanding tree folk who then have to deal with all of these undergrowth plants running about and dying and living and dying and being this perennial, like, nuisance of young people to this eternal old people population. But I just can't, off the top of my head, like, aside from, oh, it's sap, I can't really think of anything for how you would go from Ents to Mandragoras.
A simple mutation.
Yeah.
I mean, that's really all it takes. It's just one switch of a gene.
I'd still like something to keep that idea of them being born from a kind of like outside insemination, a slightly unnatural thing, instead of just, it's a new species because it mutated.
Maybe it was, I don't know, an acorn that was baked too long in the sun before it got planted.
That could be a good idea.
Or like a seed that was frozen.
Yeah.
Or, you know, those plants that have to be burned before they can seed.
Oh, God, yeah.
Like one that was burned at slightly too low a temperature.
Yeah.
Something like that.
Yeah.
Any kind of thing, like you said, something unnatural, something that would not work with what it's usually supposed to be.
Yeah.
But yeah, send your ideas too, please.
Yes, please.
Sorry, I didn't mean to take you guys a spotlight there, honestly. It's just that I...
There will always be other ideas.
Yes, please, and we would love to hear them.
Yeah. And, you know, that's dryads.
That's dryads.
And Mandragoras and Ents and Aurons and Audreys and Cacti.
That's plants.
Yeah.
That's plants.
It's plants.
Can you imagine, like not even a dryad, but, like, an ent all, like, dolled up and dressed up in, like, metal jewelry and everything, and it's like, trying to present itself as attractive to a non-plant, and you're like...
It's got blush just covered over, like, just random leaves.
Oh, my God. Or, like, you've got this big mass of, like, humanoid-looking vines just trying to chatter with a humanoid, and you're like, this is really, really disturbing.
It's definitely strange.
Again, I keep playing up the weird part of this because it is so strange to me.
Yeah.
Just the thought of them trying to sort of fit in with humanity.
Yeah. But, you know, I'm sure there's things that they would definitely become good at. You know, just the old guys that sit at that one table at the coffee shop that just yell for hours.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Definitely. That would be them. 100%. Like, they, eventually, at one point, they actually root in the bar.
Yeah, yeah.
It's like, it's the one customer you can't get rid of, but, you know, they pay pretty all right.
Yeah, they're fine.
They tip well.
They buy a lot of tea and play World of Warcraft.
Yes, exactly. They never move.
Yeah.
But they have, like, 8 level 90 characters.
But, yeah, feel free to send us your questions, your comments, your ideas, anything.
Please, anything. We'd love to hear it.
Yeah. Next episode is going to be
Kenku and Tengu.
Yes. Good old bird people.
Yes. We're going to cover the squawks, the beaks, the talons, all of it.
Yeah.
It'll be a good time, I think.
Yeah.
So anything you want to ask about them, please do. We'd love to hear it. We'll answer your questions about, you know, about plant people, bird people, any other kind of people, any other kind of non-people.
Yeah.
Whatever you want.
Yeah. Yeah, please. You know. You can find me on Twitter, email, Tumblr, whatever, as Pagetish.
Yep. GNOLLBARD.
Yeah. Again, the Creature Culture Ask Box is always open.
Yep.
We've got a couple questions in through there. We've got a couple questions through people getting contact with Nolbard.
Yep.
Yeah.
I'm always happy to talk with you. Just any subject. Just hit me up. I'll definitely respond.
Yeah.
If I'm still here, I'll respond.
Yeah. Wow, we got through an entire episode without talking about D&D.
We did, didn't we?
Yeah.
What the shit?
Bless.
Achievement unlocked.
Yeah. But yeah, send us all your best gardening tips.
Oh, definitely. Gardening, cooking. If you want vegetarian meals, send it. We'll probably give it a try.
Yeah. Send us your best highly nitrogen meal. Particularly on...